When we started this food podcast a few months ago, little did I know the things I would learn, the people I would meet, and how beautifully complex the world of food really is. My goal was to find answers, and yet in the process, I've found so many new questions too. But one thing for sure, I soon realized that food is about so much more than fueling our bodies. Each of us has a long history and a personal relationship with food. In some cultures, thinness is believed to show that you are fit and healthy. In other cultures, being thin is viewed as a sign that you are sickly. The concept of healthy eating is one that not only plays out in our physical well-being, but our mental and emotional health too. For too long, a toxic diet culture and society at large have dictated that healthy eating is defined by how we look, when nothing could be further from the truth. As I was about to discover, healthy eating has far less to do with restricting and restraining ourselves and far more to do with finding our food freedom. I'm Ridi Kabi, and this is Food for Thought, the podcast designed to demystify the food landscape, brought to you by Woolworths. As I considered what it means to eat healthily, I wanted to know how we can eat in a way that is nourishing, not only for our bodies, but also for our minds and our families and communities. What is the effect of diet culture on our collective and individual psyche? And how is the progressive health at every size revolution changing this for the better? In this episode, it's about to get personal. Because who of us has not been affected in a society that bombards us with confusing, often contradictory messaging about our bodies and how to be healthy? I'll be speaking to a health at every size informed practitioner and an author and dietitian who explains the cultural dynamics at play in our approach to food. We'll look at how our time-starved lifestyles, information overload, and the dieter dilemma are linked to not only disease and poor physical health, but poor mental and emotional health too. Just a quick note that the content shared on this podcast is for discussion and information purposes only and should not be taken as advice. The views and opinions discussed here are those of the podcast host and guests and do not represent those of Woolworths. So let's get going. According to a 2022 World Economic Forum article, a survey conducted by Ipsos in December 2021 among over 1,100 US adults showed that COVID-19 has made people more health conscious and willing to change their lifestyles to stay well. Until recently, people interested in improving their health automatically referred to physical health. But thankfully, mental and other areas of health are gaining the time, attention, and consideration that have long been needed. And yet, global and local statistics show an increase in lifestyle diseases like atherosclerosis, which is a hardening of the arteries, heart disease, strokes, having too much body fat, and type 2 diabetes. According to a UN article on lifestyle diseases by Associate Professor of Community Medicine, Fatma Al-Maskari, maintaining a healthy weight, exercising regularly, following a healthy diet, and not smoking seem to be associated with a reduction of as much as 80% in the risk of developing the most common lifestyle diseases. But despite the well-known benefits of a, quote, healthy lifestyle, unquote, only a small proportion of adults follow such a routine, and the numbers are unfortunately declining. As I set off to get the skinny on the subject of healthy eating, I realized that skinny is probably a good place to kick off the conversation. I was reminded of a conversation I had almost 10 years ago with the late Doras Tole, a chef, author, and editor who guided food culture in South Africa during her career of over 40 years in food. Dora joined me as a guest on my program on Al Jazeera, South to North, and I remember telling her that I come from the township where the big mamas who raised me used to think that being thin is a sign of illness. You have to be well endowed in order to show prosperity and health. This conversation with Dora made me realize how badly we all need more knowledge on what it means to be healthy and less guilty about trying to follow the latest diet trends, whether we are professional chefs or a parent cooking for our family. According to researcher and author Linda Bacon in an article for National Geographic, we shouldn't worry about whether our body is big or small. While people might think they can tell who's fit and who's not by looking at them, it's actually a lot trickier than that. Many avid dancers, runners, lifters, and sports team members are big to start with, and they stay that way. They tend to be far healthier than thin people who don't move around much or eat a nutritious mix of foods. Saying that everybody needs to be the same weight is like saying that all people should be the same height, says Linda. Your body's weight is determined by genetics, not how healthy you are, and this idea underpins the Health at Every Size movement. I contacted Natalie Matt, a Health at Every Size informed practitioner and the spokesperson for the Association for Dietetics in South Africa, to hear more. Okay, Natalie, I confess, this sounds like a very radical idea to me. Healthy at every size, is that even possible? I'm skeptical here.
Yes, this is a really counter-cultural idea. So the term, and people get it confused all the time, is health at every size, not healthy. And the idea, well, the term was first coined and is registered by the Association for Size, Diversity and Health. And their mission is to spread this idea that health doesn't have one look, one shape, one size. They're saying that health occurs on a continuum. And wherever you are right now, you can take care of your body, your stress, your sleep, your movement in a way that will help you get better, feel healthier, be healthier. And so what they have effectively tried to tell people, and this is their like mission statement, is that you should not be discriminated against because your body does not necessarily fit the image of healthy, and that all people, independent of their size, should be allowed access to healthcare. So you can't kind of say, well, only thin people can have knee replacements. Only thin people can have cholesterol medication. We really want to take care of every body, wherever it is, without weight stigma. And the reason they really highlight the weight stigma is because it is incredibly damaging to have discrimination against people based purely on their physical shape and size.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, though, I mean, you know, with these kind of conversation, we've got to be careful, right, that we don't discourage people who want to be leaner, but at the same time, we don't stigmatize those who are perceived to be bigger. What is the right balance? How do we strike the right messaging? And I'll just throw myself out there and make myself vulnerable, because I'm always trying to lose weight. I'm a runner. I eat healthily. I could do with a few more kilos off, but it doesn't matter how hard I work, it doesn't seem to happen. Should I just say, you know what, I'm at my best possible health and that's enough?
This is such a good question. And the easy answer, there's no easy answer, is we're all raised talking this language of wanting to be thinner and wanting to weigh less because we've been told this is healthy. This is what we should all aspire to. But the truth is, maybe your genetics really are going to keep you in a certain weight range. And when you listen to your body and you give it enough nutrients to get through the day, concentrate on whatever work you're doing and perform the running, the mothering, all the tasks that you have to do, when you give yourself enough nutrition to get through that day, your weight will still stay in that range. And when you go, no, I've got a big race coming up, I need to be super light, that in order to get those 1 or 2 kgs down further from there, it takes so much focus. It takes so much away from the rest of your life that really your whole focus becomes on losing weight and maintaining that lower weight. That is not healthy.
I love it. I love it. I could speak to you all day. Okay, let's talk about then HAES, Health at Every Size. How is it different then to dieting, or how does it even change our approach to dieting?
It is not the opposite of dieting. And that's where a lot of people get confused. They think, well, if you're HAES informed, you must just hate diets and want to eat chocolate all day. Not at all. Dieting is about manipulating the body to manipulate its size above all else. And that is not what Haze is about. Haze is about looking at the whole individual, finding ways to move that make this person feel good, finding ways for them to access care that is fair and considers them the whole person, not just their body and their body size. It's also about eating for well-being. And an important component of what eating for well-being that dieting completely ignores is eating for pleasure, because we all exist in a social context. And we all know that, like, your mom will make you something really comforting, a taste from your childhood that you love. You shouldn't feel bad for finding that enjoyable. You should be allowed to savor that and feel how important it is as part of your heritage and being alive.
If dieting was not the answer, I was curious to learn more about how best to approach eating in a wholesome way. With more information available than ever before and influencers promoting a new IT diet every year, are we actually getting better informed on what healthy eating really is, or are we just becoming overwhelmed and more confused? Diet culture fuels a society in which appearance and body shape are more important than physical, mental, and general well-being. And this is why diet culture can be so dangerous, becoming a risk factor for body dysmorphia, eating disorders, and mental and physical health issues. I was so interested to hear of the intuitive eating approach to food and asked Natalie to tell me more about it from her perspective.
Our bodies are so wise. Our bodies know so much. So I want you to think about when your kids were babies and you were feeding them, whether they're getting a breast or a bottle or whatever it was, how your children were fed, they would control their intake. They knew when they had had enough. And we know that most children below the age of 3 are really able to express what they need, whether they're thirsty or hungry. They have an intuitive relationship with their appetite. It is past the age of 3 that we start learning, you know what, if I eat all of this, my gran gets happy. Or if I eat this piece of chocolate, like, I actually feel quite nice. So we learn to get other signals around eating that can get in the way of that intuitive relationship. But in general, we are all born as intuitive eaters who are able to tell what we need.
Of course, embracing health at every size is not to deny some of the very real factors at play, especially in the South African context where obesity statistics are alarming. According to a provincial government report, roughly 31% of men and 68% of women in South Africa are obese, with obesity defined as having too much body fat. Excess body fat, especially in your waist area, is of particular concern, as once your waistline goes above certain levels, it increases your risk of high blood pressure, diabetes, and cardiovascular diseases, although not necessarily causing these diseases. A high-risk waistline is 80 centimeters or higher for women and 94 centimeters or higher for men. Considering the massive inequality in our country, one person's healthy lifestyle may include all the latest superfoods and exercise trends, while another person may be eating as healthily as they can if they simply have a plate of food in front of them. We cannot overlook the desperate need for solutions to hunger and poverty in combating unhealthy eating in South Africa. Plenty of studies have shown that poor nutrition can impact optimal brain development and impair its normal functioning. A 2019 study by Huang and colleagues in the journal Antioxidants shows the link between high-fat Western diets and sugar-sweetened beverages and a higher risk of depression or depressive symptoms. Experts in the journal Nutrients showed the effect of high-fat diets on oxidative stress, cellular inflammatory response, and cognitive function. And a study in the International Journal of Molecular Sciences indicated a strong relationship between systemic insulin resistance and higher incidence of neurodegeneration, dementia, and mild cognitive impairment. But a diet rich in antioxidants found in plant foods can stop or delay free radicals from damaging your body and your brain. Because of this gut-brain connection, diet really does affect mood and mental well-being. Instead of containing plenty of fresh fruit and vegetables, less processed grains and modest amounts of dairy, lean meat, fish, and seafood, Western diets are full of highly refined sugars, meat, and fats. This is considered a pro-inflammatory diet. Forbidding certain food groups altogether can have a detrimental effect on our relationship with food, though. Healthy eating is about striking a balance. You can still enjoy your favorite foods, even if they are less than ideal. But the key is eating them only once in a while and balancing them with more nutritious foods and physical activity. In the health and wellness space, food freedom has become an increasingly popular approach to eating that challenges societal norms of dieting and the misconception of thin as an ideal. According to a 2022 Healthline article, practitioners seek to build a positive and judgment-free relationship with all foods, where guilt is not considered an ingredient in the eating experience. I love the story of Jessica Kotlovitz, a registered dietitian who was kind enough to share her personal journey to food freedom with me. Jessica, I love, love, love the concept of food freedom. It just conjures up some agency and control and happy feelings around food. How do you define food freedom?
So I think food freedom is really about giving yourself permission to eat everything that you really want to eat. It's not about, you know, going and binging on all the chocolates and chips in the world, because I don't think our bodies are truly asking us to do that or truly, you know, feeling happy when we do those sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. So your own journey, I mean, I know you are a dietitian and that's wonderful, but how did you arrive at this point of a personal journey to food freedom? What did that look like?
I think I spent most of my life dieting. I always struggled with my weight growing up and I was always obsessed with trying to be thinner. And I got to a point, obviously I studied dietetics, I think because I developed such an interest in weight loss and health, or, you know, after all these years of dieting. And then I began helping other people on their weight loss journeys. And I just really saw that it wasn't making anyone happier. It never made me happier. And I never got to a point where I was like, well, I have arrived. I'm at this weight I've always wanted to be at. And now I can just move on with my life. It just becomes an obsession. And some people do get to their goal weight, but they don't always sustain it or don't usually sustain it. And again, like, why is it so important in life to look a specific way? Like, shouldn't we be focusing more on, you know, our goals and aspirations and mental health? And there's just so much more to life than weight and a number on the scale.
Okay. That really, really resonates with me because, you know, I'm a serial dieter, not so much now that I'm in my 40s and after discovering running and how much it means to me and that I need to feed my body in order to keep exercising. But I still diet and want to be a little 2 kilos lighter. And then when I reach it through bad habits, I lose it. I feel great. And a couple of weeks later, it's back again. Right? So it's this dance that goes on for the rest of your life. But I think you are suggesting that we can liberate ourselves from that restrictive and unhappy space.
I mean, I totally agree with what Natalie said. And for sure, I think that is the answer. Like, intuitive eating is really the answer to food freedom and becoming free of this, you know, diet mentality and this negative spiral that a lot of us are in our entire lives. And learning how to really tune in and listen to what our bodies are telling us and asking us to eat. And when our bodies are asking us to stop eating, because a lot of us really struggle with overeating too.
All right. So if we are to start a new personal journey right now to arrive at a point of food freedom, we are learning in this podcast that our background, how we're brought up around food, cultural practices, even the political is so overwhelming when trying to make your personal choices. Where should we start? Someone listening to us today and they just want to start on this journey to food freedom. What are those basic things they can start incorporating right now to arrive there?
Sure. It's really such a journey. And I think perhaps reading some books on intuitive eating is a great place to start. And where I love to start with my patients is just starting to tune in to your hunger and fullness signals. I really think that's the first place, because so many of us are so out of tune. We don't even notice when we're hungry. We don't even notice when we're full. And I'm not talking about bursting full or starving hungry. I'm talking about what comes before that. Like, you know, do you notice when you're starting to think about food? And do you know that that's the first sign of hunger? And do you respond to that or do you ignore that? And most of us ignore our very, very early signals of hunger and fullness, and we don't respond until our bodies are really screaming at us. So when we're uncomfortably full or uncomfortably hungry, and intuitive eating is such a beautiful journey, because when you start to listen to your body more when it comes to fullness and hunger, you start to listen to your body more when it comes to everything.
Jessica's story about finding food freedom made me think about my own relationship with food. At the heart of the food freedom concept, as expressed in the Healthline article mentioned previously, it is the idea of cultivating self-trust around food and rejecting unnecessary restrictions. I love the idea, and I love the concept that in order to avoid eating in response to external cues, such as the sight or smell of food, I can become more aware of my internal cues of hunger and fullness and then respond to those cues instead. I also began considering the role that my cultural upbringing has played in my relationship with food. I spoke to Mpotsu Gudu, a registered dietitian, master in food culture, communication and marketing, and co-author of self-help recipe book Eat Ting with Anna Tropido. She has some wonderful insights about this important aspect of healthy eating. Mpo, welcome. What a pleasure to just speak to you. And I'm very excited about our topic because it speaks to the diversity that is South Africa. It's one thing, or in the world even, it's one thing to be talking about food, sustainability, our relationship with food. But if we don't take into account who we are and our identity, then we're not going to make an impact. Why is cultural background important to our understanding of what we eat and how we eat it?
Culture is important because it influences healthy eating, because food is an expression of culture. The way we cook, the way we eat has been woven into our days, how some communities still harvest their food, how they plant the food, and everybody gets to partake in this experience. It's a way of sharing food and also the rituals, and it's important as part of well-being and also as part of education about what food means to people.
Mm-hmm. And can you just share with us then, in your line of work, how you apply those cultural differences? You know, what are the cultural dynamics that are at play when we speak about health and eating?
I think it's also understanding what food means to different people, especially in the African culture. We know that we have certain foods that we eat when we are mourning, and the older people explain that you can't have salt because you are sad, so you're not supposed to be experiencing any culture, any pleasure. But then when it's a wedding and something that is celebratory, you see there's cake and sweet foods and, you know, what we call seven colors. And you also need to understand culturally the taboos that are in specific cultures. You often hear in some deep rural areas that they would tell you that unmarried girls don't eat eggs because it promotes sexual excitation, but yet we know that eggs are an affordable, healthy source of protein. So, you know, not speaking of ill of those, but just to understand them and educate them, and just to understand also that there are some good that comes from our cultures, that our grandmothers knew what, without even using fancy terms, that they knew what organic food is. They understood local sustainable farming. They understood the whole nose to tail eating, how eating the whole plant, how slow cooking meat is much more important, how they were farming regeneratively. So bringing those, you know, what we say, the good of it and the bad of it into the consultation and respecting the person and finding a way for them to eat healthy and not making them alienated, you know. In I always say that you don't have to choose between health and culture. You don't have to lose who you are for somebody to help you with eating healthy for a health condition or just to live a healthy life.
I'm so glad you said that. Is there a greater appreciation for the role of culture now when food choices are being made, when food policies, whether it is at schools or hospitals or wherever people gather to eat, are we moving in the right direction in incorporating cultural understandings as we move forward, or is there still some way to go?
There's still a long way to go. I often meet dietitians and even chefs who've just qualified. A lot of them don't understand the value of indigenous foods, mainly because some of them didn't grow up with them, or some like me, I grew up with the foods, but they were never presented as healthy. I had sorghum at home every day with different types of leaves and fruits. But when I got to school, I was presented with apple and all the, what we call the Western foods as them being healthy. So my mother could not look at me and say, sorghum is healthy for you because it has this and that. And I would, we value the teachers more than our parents in terms of knowledge. So we still have not incorporated cultural ways of eating. And when we're talking about sustainability, we're talking about caring for the environment. Indigenous grains, they don't use as much water. They're actually drought resistant, and they are very, very nutritious.
I was beginning to feel a lot more empowered, knowing that I don't need to cut out food groups completely or deprive myself according to every new IT diet. But I can focus on instinctual eating and good, honest food. So it was Cindy Chin, a nutrition manager and a registered dietitian at Woolworths, who really helped me to get to grips with the simplicity of healthy eating principles. As Cindy explained the Woolworths Health Manifesto to me, I felt so inspired to apply the simple yet sound values and principles to my own eating habits. So Cindy joins us now. I'm very pleased to talk to you, Cindy, about the Woolworths Food Manifesto. Quite a catchy phrase. I associate manifestos with political party action. What does this all mean?
Thanks, Rudy. Lovely to chat to you. Well, it came about with, it was really a profession of what we believe in as a food retailer. And it was there, we developed it as our intent for future sustainable food system. So not only guides product development internally, but also a declaration to our customers about what we believe good food is about. For instance, when I was in practice, say 10, 15 years ago, I would idealistically just say to my patients, eat more oily fish, but not considering necessarily the impact on the environment. So where's the fish coming from? Is the ocean being taken care of? And in a sense, that's irresponsible because we actually do have to consider where our food comes from, how it's produced. Is it produced ethically, considering the communities that are producing the food for us, considering are the animals taken care of in an ethical way? So it's beyond just healthy eating. And that's what I love about the manifesto. It's all encapsulating. And it has moved on from some of the principles. We started out with more of a healthy sort of food dietary guidelines. So you'll see in stores, it will say eat food with less saturated fat, salt and sugar. But we've actually gone a bit beyond that over the years because this was developed in, say, 2015, I think. Subsequent to that, we've incorporated more sustainability principles into our manifesto. For example, we talk about eating a diverse diet full of sustainably farmed plants, vegetables and fruits, packed with vitamins and minerals. So it's quite a loaded statement. The whole thing with when you eat a diverse diet, you get a bigger variety of nutrients from the different plant foods, right? At the same time, the impact on the environment is less because you have less monocultures. Like your farming practices are better and more diverse, better for the environment, better for soil health. So not only are we addressing the importance of eating more fruits, vegetables, and plant foods, for your own health, for preventing disease like cancers and heart disease and diabetes, but you're also considering the impact of those food choices on the environment.
So when I pick up the Woolworths Health Manifesto, what I will find is not just a diet. It's not just what to eat
and when to eat. It sounds as if there's an educational element, but there's also some sort of contract, because that's what a manifesto is, right? We're getting into some sort of contractual relationship where you bring something to the table, I bring something to the table. So just talk to me around the kind of behavior then that you wish to inspire through the health manifesto.
Yeah, I love the way you've worded that, because it is about our responsibility as food manufacturers and retailers, and also the customer's responsibility to make better food choices and choices that are more beneficial or less harmful to the planet. So, for instance, we talk about, so I'm going into a bit of the detail here, but for instance, as a dietitian, I would recommend that you shouldn't eat too much meat, and definitely choose leaner cuts of meat, for instance. So from a health point of view, as a customer, you can make that choice, but then also consider, how has that animal been raised? Have they used unnecessary hormones and antibiotics routinely without consideration for the animal's own welfare? So and we're not perfect by any means, and we're definitely on a journey to improve the way our meat is produced, but we do offer those choices to our customers. So you'll get free-range meat, never treated with growth hormones or routine antibiotics, as an example.
I loved the realization that I can take these basic guidelines and tailor them according to my preferences. For instance, knowing that leafy greens, which are packed with phytonutrients, have been proven by science to be a healthy choice, I may choose to enjoy morocco or spinach instead of kale, according to my preference, taste, culture, or even my budget. Perhaps I love lentils, or perhaps traditional African grains are more suited to my taste. The concept remains unchanged. We need to move back to basics and eat the way our bodies were designed to, if we want to keep them in peak physical and mental health. Instead of cooking a wholesome meal and sharing it with family or friends as a meaningful time of connection, it's all too easy to eat processed meals behind our computer or TV screens, or shovel down a snack on the go. Sometimes we even eat when we aren't hungry, to distract ourselves from an emotional need or attempt to relieve stress or loneliness. But I was now resolved to practice mindful eating. As one help guide on mental health puts it, mindful eating is the opposite of this kind of unhealthy, mindless eating. Mindful eating isn't about being perfect, always eating the right things, or never allowing yourself to eat on the go again. And it's not about establishing strict rules for how many calories you can eat or which foods you have to include or avoid in your diet. Rather, it's about focusing all your senses and being present as you shop for, cook, serve, and eat your food. And that sounds like a healthy, manageable, and sustainable way of eating to me. That sounds like food freedom. I'm Ridi Tlhabi, journalist, producer, and author, host of Food for Thought, a podcast designed to demystify the food landscape, brought to you by Woolworths. You'll find all podcast episodes at www.woolworths.co.za/podcast or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you for joining us. We look forward to having you along for the next episode of Food for Thought. If you enjoyed this episode, you can dig deeper at www.woolworths.co.za. And if you are enjoying this podcast, please give this channel a follow. You can also rate and review it wherever you listen to your podcasts.